Welcome to The Telegram. I'm Tim Stanley. It's time to give David Cameron a break. The Tory PM has saved the economy and reformed welfare, yet still his backbenchers revolt. Why are they doing it, and what can they possibly hope to achieve? We let some of the brightest writers on the right duke it out. Also, Quentin Tarantino won't make his movie if people already know what's in it. We discuss what's behind his Titanic's drop and what makes him such a unique artist. I'm joined by the former MP and blogger Louise Mensch, The Telegraph's Peter Oborne and Janet Daly, and by our chief movie critic, Robbie Collin. Everything should be coming up roses for David Cameron. GDP grew at 1.9% last year, and we enjoyed the biggest quarterly increase in employment on record. Welfare reform is getting bums off armchairs, and Michael Gove's education revolution has improved schooling for 250,000 pupils, all in time for victory in 2015. But Mr. Cameron still has a major stumbling block, his own party. There have been backbench rebellions over gay marriage, the Lords, war in Syria, the proposed referendum on Europe, and now immigration. Why, oh why, is the Tory right doing this? Cameron has made Conservative economics work. He's tackling welfare, and he's even promised them a vote on Europe. He's more popular than Ed Miliband, too. Labour's poll lead is down to just 1 point. So why risk losing the next election? This week, The Telegraph wrote, "David Cameron's economic medicine is working. Tories should support him." The Spectator concluded, "There is a time to rally behind a leader and his agenda for the sake of the country. It should be clear to all but the most blind Conservative MP that that time has come." Janet Daly, isn't it time for the rebels to cut Dave some slack?
The rebels are not rebelling on any of the issues that you mentioned. They're not rebelling on education, they're not rebelling on benefit cuts, they're not rebelling on the reforming of the economy and the successful economic growth. They are rebelling, as we insist on putting it, which is to say they are disagreeing with their party leadership's policy on a very specific issue in this case, which is the question of whether you can send immigrants home if they've committed crimes and so on. The provision in the European Bill of Human Rights that allows courts to overrule the Home Secretary on this issue. And that happens to be something which the overwhelming majority of the population agrees with. Now, if you're going to say that every MP who is elected to Parliament must follow blindly and unquestioningly and without any mitigation every policy that its leadership chooses to adopt, what is the point of the democratic process? Why not just let the leadership appoint the MPs? The point is they are there to answer not just to their own party, but to their own constituents and to the country as a whole. And if they believe in all sincerity that their objection, that the debate that they are trying to open is on an issue that the public feels very strongly about, why shouldn't that aspect of public opinion be represented among the political class? If the political class all gangs up together and says there can be no questioning of this policy or any policy, there can be no open debate, there can be no argument, are we living in a democracy at all?
Okay. Let me put that question then to Louise Mensch, who joins us down the line from New York. Louise, these MPs, these rebels, they're just simply doing their job, right?
Well, I don't know. I think, you know, you always... I was told on my first day as an MP that the quickest way to become a top Tory, quote-unquote, was to have a pop at the government. That would give you an immediate promotion and everybody in the media would immediately refer to you as a top Tory. I myself voted against the government once. I voted against them on Lords reforms since I thought that Clegg's plans for a sort of 15-year terms were ridiculous. And I went into the lobbies as an independent MP. But I think when your government is doing really well in a tight situation where you've lost one very significant structural battle, which is the battle over boundary changes, that you've got to be judicious in how you rebel and how you express your views, particularly on this issue over the jurisdiction of the European Court. It's certainly my understanding that the government is doing its level best to change that. They are challenging the European Court when they can. They are encouraging our judges to have their own interpretation. The European Court of Human Rights, of course, is not exactly part of the EU. And every time Cameron has gone to Brussels, and people have had low expectations of him, he's come back and surprised people with how strong he's been. I have every confidence that right before the election, the laundry list of things he wants from the EU as part of the renegotiation package is going to be a very strong one indeed.
Peter Oborne, Louise makes a very good point there about how because things are so tight for the next election because of the boundary changes, MPs should be particularly careful in this parliament about how they behave.
Well, I think there's a broader point than that, which is that the Tory MPs who are in Parliament now came into Parliament as following the Conservative manifesto. They weren't elected as Louise Mensch or whoever it might be. They were elected as the Conservative candidate following the Conservative manifesto. If they disagreed with the Conservative manifesto, they were at liberty to stand as an independent and see how far that got them. The answer is, it wouldn't have got them anywhere. And that is why loyalty, I agreed very much of a lot of what Louise Mensch was saying there, is very important. It is owed to a leader. And it puzzles me, this sense that Tory MPs individually are somehow more important than either the party which they represent or indeed the nation.
Janet, you're shaking your head.
Yeah, one of the things that has caused most alienation and cynicism about politics, not just in this country, but in America particularly as well, is the idea that politicians are just out for their own career chances. And the way to suck up to the leadership, the way to get ahead is to suck up to the leadership, not to cause trouble. And the feeling of the general public is that there's a kind of conspiracy among the political class against their discontents, their concerns. Nobody's really listening because all people care about is getting a cabinet job, getting a job on the front bench. There has to be a feeling that the constituency MP is there not just to be loyal to the leadership in some kind of Masonic sense, you know, of a blood vow to support the leadership under any circumstances. I think many of these rebels would claim that they were more in the spirit of the original Tory manifesto on which they were elected than the kind of compromises and concessions that they see the leadership making. Also, I think there's a case for saying that the reason, as Louise says, that David Cameron is likely to get concessions from the EU is because of the pressure. It may be very convenient, in fact, for the leadership to be getting this kind of pressure from the right wing of its own party, who are saying you mustn't come back without the right concessions. That strengthens his hand.
Louise, how did you as an MP make a distinction between being someone who very much stood up for what she believed in but did not hurt the party? I mean, that to me seems to be the key tension here.
Well, I don't know. I think there's a little bit of unfairness going on here. I don't think any serious commentator could look at the 2010 intake and say that it has not been an incredibly individual intake, one that has eschewed the normal path of slavish devotion to the Prime Minister in order to pass up the ministerial ladder. You've seen an entire new ecosystem coming forward as the independent backbencher with a constituency of his or her own, and I don't mean the voting constituency, like Sarah Wollaston MP. You've seen the rise of the Select Committee and various alternative career paths, and you've seen MPs who've gained prominence on the backbenches by championing their own causes, people like Robert Halfen. And you've seen, I think, an incredibly independent parliament, and it's one of the best things about the much-derided A-list. You had a lot of independent MPs who made their own way. But actually, the Conservative Party is asking itself the wrong question. If you always focus on, should we or should we not be attacking the Prime Minister, you're looking, frankly, in the wrong place. I'd like to see more exhortation to our bright and individual MPs, especially the right-wingers, on how can they more effectively attack Labour when they're down. I want to see them kicking their balls when he's down. We need to not only be saying, let's support the Prime Minister and give him a chance to go to Europe and come back with an extremely strong package, as I'm sure that he will do. He is a natural Eurosceptic. Rather, let us concentrate on attacking Labour, and to some extent, now is the time to start properly attacking the Liberal Democrats for how they are holding us back. The coalition was always an uneasy marriage, and it is headed towards an electoral divorce. I want to see my colleagues, my former colleagues, having a go at Vince Cable in particular, why he is allowed to get away with attacking the Chancellor all the time with his failed support for Plan B is beyond me.
Peter Abel.
What do you want to know?
What I want to know is whether or not you you see in all of this a group of backbenchers who are devoted more to bringing down the Prime Minister than they are necessary to maintaining a Tory majority. I mean, that for me sort of goes to the heart of all of this. Are they really motivated by something not to do with them representing their constituents, but to do with a long blood feud with David Cameron himself?
Yeah, I think that it's important to remember that the Conservative Party has existed for 200 years now, you know, or more, in its modern form really since the Second Reform Act. It's the most successful governing party in the Western world.
Right.
And that's been based on pragmatic compromise, coalition, and something called loyalty, which is a massive thing, loyalty, which is to put aside one's own interests in and act against one's own beliefs sometimes in the interests of a greater whole. And what you have, I think, nowadays is a manifestation of a modern consciousness where the individual matters more than institutions, than society, than and is all important. The idea of subordinating one's own visceral preferences, one's own needs. You know, we live in the world of the selfie, and the Conservative Party is in the world of the selfie, and that portion of it which is rebelling. And I think that
Janet, I'll let you come in.
But they're also this position that this particular rebellion is about is defending a considerable proportion of the electorate, Peter. This is not just some self-indulgent whim that they're going on. This isn't even the Maastricht rebellion. This is about what most people happen to be concerned about. And the idea that you immolate the interests, I mean, democratic politics is about argument. It's about debate. If it isn't about that, what is it about? And if you can't open an argument, and if the leadership will not address your arguments and your discontents and those of your constituents, what is the point of all this?
Peter.
Well, let's have a look at this, what you're saying. I mean, the response to the immigration problem, there is a problem of immigration, is that we should go back on the transitional arrangements. That's quite a lot of the Tories are saying. Now, go back on the transitional arrangements basically means pulling out of Europe. Now, that's fine. It's logical. It's consistent. Except that the Conservative Party did not fight the last election. Don't interrupt me quite yet. Did not fight the last election on the proposition that Britain should withdraw from Europe. Had it done so, I would respect the people and the Conservative Party who want to go back on the transitional arrangements. Similarly, the European Court of Human Rights. I understand lots of people dislike it. Now, if the Tory party had fought the last election on tearing up the Human Rights Act, which it did not, it had some obscure formula to do with something else, then again I would respect them. They are not fighting on the manifesto which they pledged to the voters and were voted in on.
Janet.
But the specific rebellion, the Dominic Raab rebellion, is about allowing the Home Secretary to overrule the European Court of Human Rights, which is refusing to allow us to eject immigrants who commit crimes. This is a very, very specific condition. It's not a question of pulling out of the EU or even necessarily reversing the transitional arrangements. That's a different issue, a different rebellion. The one we're talking about here is to do with giving the Home Secretary power to overrule court judgments. And it doesn't seem to me that there is any contradiction between what was in the manifesto and what that rebellion suggests.
I'm afraid I don't accept. You can't pick and choose the Human Rights Act, so I do think there is a grave contradiction. Now, they can put stuff in the next manifesto, and there's an argument to be had about that. But at the moment, the rebels are being incredibly self-indulgent, many of them.
Louise, would you agree with that characterisation of the rebels, self-indulgent?
Yes, I would. I think that Dominic is being, I must say that Dominic is being particularly foolish. He knows perfectly well that the government and the Home Secretary are constantly looking for ways to override stupid rulings from the European Court of Human Rights. Now, the Tory payroll, it's just been announced, are going to abstain on the Raab amendment. The Lib Dems are going to vote against. At least we will see their true colours, but it will, of course, be defeated because Labour will vote against it. And it putting the government in this sort of farcical position is what Raab has done. There was never any question that he was going to dictate the way in which the government tries to decouple us from European superstate justice. That is already on the government's agenda. Can there be anything more provocative and facile than organising a rebellion against something which the government already has in hand and which will be part of its shopping list when it goes to the EU to do its major renegotiation? It's a very much sort of look-at-me politics without a point, sort of rebels without a clue. Cameron's got this under control. It's already on his agenda.
Do you think his hand will not be strengthened by this rebellion when he is negotiating for that concession in the EU?
This rebellion will be forgotten in 10 days. absolutely forgotten. People will be going to the EU. When he goes to the EU...
It won't be forgotten by him, though, will it? It won't be forgotten by Cameron. He will know that he has to come home and face this proportion of his party and the stirring up of public opinion on this issue. So he will have to take a very strong position when he goes for his negotiation.
He always was going to take a very strong position. And I think if you look at the statements that have come out from Chris Grayling and the statements that have come out from British judges who have already set aside rulings they don't like on, the European Court of Human Rights attempts to dictate British law, that's already happening. And this will be a sideshow compared to the major issues that people want to see Cameron renegotiate at the EU. Number one is, of course, immigration and our control over our borders and restrictions on the right of totally unfettered free movement within the EU. That is by far and away the public's greatest concern with EU negotiation, and it is by far and away the government's greatest concern.
I agree, and I think good luck with that. I can't say that I think he's going to get any major concessions on that.
Peter, do you think there's a case for saying, Peter, that the rebellions have actually made David Cameron a better prime minister? They've made him actually have to deal with Parliament. They've made him actually have to consider the concerns of his backbenchers. And in this example, I mean, what we're unpicking here with Europe, possibly he's actually going to the EU with a ironically stronger hand, because he's going to say to them, look, I've got to keep these people happy, so I've got to be a little more principled and firm in my negotiations.
Cares that much what the EU thinks. You know, he's been in this position before. They've sort of spluttered a bit, and he's always gone in fairly heavy-handed with them. He's used his veto before when they didn't want him to. And he's not dumb. He's got very clever people around him, and he is himself a very clever man. And he is a natural Eurosceptic, although he's never been a better off outer. I think he wants the free trade that comes from Europe. He doesn't want a Norwegian arrangement where actually they're hampered by an enormous amount of rules without getting half of the benefits. He wants properly to reform the EU alongside Angela Merkel and make it better and more fit for purpose and bring back something that the public can vote for. He wants to get rid of the UKIP challenge. He wants to shoot that fox. Indeed, it is his only chance of forming a government at the next election, and he absolutely knows this. He doesn't need a bunch of immature backbenchers jumping up and down and teaching their grandmother how to suck eggs.
Okay, Peter, I want to give you the final word. Do you think there's a tension between loyalty, as you described it so eloquently, and philosophy? Is there a case for saying that perhaps what we're seeing in the Conservative Party is the emergence of a group of people who are ideological?
Yeah,
and that there's a tension with traditional Tory deference to the leadership and a group of people who, perhaps post-Thatcher, feel they have a loyalty to something higher than that, which is a set of principles they will not break from.
I think you're making a very strong point there. I mean, there's never been such a thing, really, as a conservative ideology. It's more of an attitude to the state, a sceptical attitude of mind. And if the Conservative Party does, as Izzy saying some signs are doing, becomes an ideological party along the lines of Labour in the early 1980s, then it will have changed, and I think we'll split. I think that we may well be on the eve of a historic, momentous split inside the Conservative Party for the reasons you have just suggested.
Peter Obon, Janet Daly and Louise Mensch live from New York, thank you all very much. When the script of his proposed movie, The Hateful Eight, leaked onto the internet, Quentin Tarantino went wild. He threatened to halt production altogether, saying that his rights and privacy had been violated and that this represented a betrayal of the artistic process. Instead, he might just publish the script and let people read it rather than watch it. And if he did, you can guarantee it'll be a bestseller. The story says something about Hollywood's movies, which nowadays are advanced so heavily that you could be forgiven for sitting down to a premiere and thinking that you've seen the movie before. But it also says something about the appeal of the unique talent of Quentin Tarantino, a man who, in the words of Yukio Mishima, writes poetry with blood. Robbie, what exactly is Tarantino complaining about?
Well, it's the fact that people have seen this script, I think, before he is ready for it to be released. You know, Tarantino is very big on film criticism. He loves analysis of films. He loves analysis of his films, and he reads articles about himself and likes to think of his scripts as being things that are worthy of being dug into. But what he's objecting to here is the fact that people are doing that before he's, you know, 100% happy with the finished script. And I think, you know, on an instinctive level, anyone can sympathise with that. Anyone who's tried to sit down and write something or create something to have someone kind kind of peeping over their shoulder before it's finished is the most exasperating thing ever. You know, you want to be happy with it before you launch that creation into the world. And that's what he's annoyed at here. It's not even the fact, I think, so much that the script has started to circulate, but then it's now gone out into the wider public domain, and anyone who is of a mind now to find this script can find it. What he said he'll do is publish it, and then perhaps in a few years' time go back to it and revise it and then make the film.
Right, right.
So in the current form in which the script is, I don't think he ever fully intended that to be, but that's absolutely par for the course for Hollywood scripts. You know, it's very, very, very difficult to judge just from a script, even from someone like Tarantino, who, you know, writes his own material and who is totally has his own house style.
Yeah.
And he knows the way of doing this. You can't sit down and read a script and think, okay, I know what the film is going to look like. Things change in the script all the time. They change on the set, they change in the editing suite, you know, they change up until pretty much release. And there's a real danger of prejudging a film too early when a script is
released. In which case, why worry about it? Because if it is just such an early draft, and I've myself read drafts of movies that haven't yet come out, and I've been done that knowing that what I will see will be completely different from that. Why worry about it so much?
Well, it's because the reaction which that the early draft provokes can be very unhealthy. Now, there was a real watershed moment for this. I think it was in 2002. It was while J.J. Abrams, who very successfully rebooted the Star Trek franchise and is now working on the new Star Wars film. So someone who's, you know, a very safe pair of hands when it comes to doing this kind of thing. He had written a Superman script for Warner Brothers. Now, the script leaked, as I say, I think it was in 2002, certainly the early thousands, and it was reviewed on a kind of a comics movie fan site, and it got an absolute pasting. And, you know, every single thing in this script that was wrong, this wasn't what a Superman film should be doing. And Warner Brothers, because this was the stage at which, you know, in the studio's relationship with the internet, Warner Brothers panicked and they pulled the project completely.
Right.
And really what was being reviewed was, first of all, it wasn't a finished script. And secondly, you know, it was a script. It wasn't a film at all.
Right.
And there can be a very kind of an unhealthy knee-jerk response to that kind of vehement criticism, particularly from a website that seemed to be absolutely Superman's target audience. You know, these people are comic book fans. They love the previous films. They're very invested in the character. And so when they read this thing and think, you know, oh, well, Superman shouldn't be doing this. Superman's home planet shouldn't look like that. Then the studio panics and go, they're right. This is going to be a flop. And so they canned it. And then what, of course, came later was the Bryan Singer film Superman Returns, which I think made it through production very, you know, relatively unscathed, and then it was released and nobody liked it anyway. So it's a very, very unhealthy thing. But what the studios have realised since this kind of watershed moment is that there is an appetite, an enormous appetite for preview material, you know, sneak peeks, early looks at things to do with films. And so they now go about fulfilling that appetite themselves. They will produce these little teaser trailers and behind-the-scenes videos that can go out to the film websites and that can kind of sate that appetite for those films.
And it works very well.
It works very well.
I was hooked on Prometheus before it even came out.
Yeah, it was an incredibly good campaign.
Fantastic videos with the android speaking and loads of shots of sets and things like that to give you a sense of what it might be like. But there's something quite unique, of course, about a Quentin Tarantino script.
Yes, I mean, he's one of the few directors who is a brand name. You know,
right.
People go and see a Tarantino film because it's by Quentin Tarantino. It doesn't matter who's in the cast, it doesn't matter what the subject is. His name is enough to drag people out to the cinema. And also,
right.
You know, to describe a film as being Tarantino-esque, people know what that means.
What does that mean?
He stands for a particular... Well, I think the notion of what is Tarantino-esque has changed quite a lot since he started making films, of course. Reservoir Dogs was his big debut, and he basically grew out of an uptick in American independent cinema. Of course, you know, the new Hollywood collapsed really around the time of Heaven's Gate. Michael Cimino obviously made this incredibly expensive Western, which totally fell apart, brought down a studio with it. This was in the early 80s. The studio collapsed. And so then American cinema hit a bit of a lull, and then there was this uptick that was sparked by people like the Coen brothers,
mm-hmm.
Tarantino as well. The rise of the Sundance Film Festival was absolutely crucial in making you know, independent American cinema a kind of a thing, an entity that people were interested in. So Reservoir Dogs grew out of that. And basically what Tarantino did is that he said that, you know, high culture, low culture, who cares? You know, dissolve the boundaries. I will, you know, love and respect both, and I will reference both in my work.
Right.
And so where you have a filmmaker like Scorsese, who's incredibly cine-literate, he'll be referencing, the work of the French New Wave, you know, the Italian neorealists, everything, you know, that's kind of semi-respectable. you will find reference in a Scorsese film. But Tarantino references the unrespectable stuff. He knows kung fu cinema inside out. Scorsese, to my knowledge, has never, you know, actively referenced a kung fu movie in one of his films. But Tarantino says, you know, it's okay to love this and it's okay to be moved by this. And so I'm going to combine these influences in my work. So, you know, one minute you're kind of harking back to Godard, the next moment you're harking back to the Shaw brothers.
Right. I think there are two things that sort of immediately I think of when I think of Tarantino. And the first is the dialogue. Now, the dialogue of a Tarantino movie, what about it that gives it that very special quality? I mean, I think there's a kind of fake realism to it.
Yeah, nobody speaks like a Tarantino character.
But for some reason, there's a kind of everyday depth, and particularly a pop culture depth to his conversation that makes you oddly think that it is something people might say, even if they don't actually speak like that. I mean, for example, the famous example is the conversation about the Royale with cheese. Two hitmen in Pulp Fiction in a car having a conversation about the different ways in which McDonald's is done in different parts of the world. The point being, on the one hand, yeah, no one ever talks like that. But on the other hand, they're talking about things people do talk about in a situation where you don't normally have that kind of conversation.
Well, that kind of dialogue in a Tarantino film, he often uses it to build tension because you think, you know, these are two men on their way to do something pretty dreadful. And yet they're talking about hamburgers. So it kind of piques your appetite for what's about to come. It's that kind of, you know, it gets you salivating in a way. It's kind of an unexpected starter before the main course of the, you know, the violence.
And then the main course is the violence. So I mean, the other controversy that he's had when it comes to dealing with critics and speaking to people was his big row about, I won't talk about the violence in my movies. When he was interviewed and he said, I'm going to shut your butt down, because he was sick and tired of being asked about the impact of violence. What do you think is the role of violence in a Tarantino movie? Is it simply schlock? Is it just to titillate the audience? Or is it actually thematically significant?
Well, I mean, I think Tarantino uses violence for all kinds of reasons. And what unites them all is the visceral response that the violence produces in the viewer. I mean, cinema is peculiarly apt medium to portray violence in. You know, it moves, and it's to do with, you know, things connecting with each other, and it's transgressive as well. It's not that film directors are all necessarily bloodthirsty people, but it's just there's something particularly about violence that lends itself to the medium of film. But because of Tarantino's encyclopedic knowledge of many different types of cinema, he's able to deploy violence in all the ways these different films have used it. So in something like Django Unchained, the violence that's meted out against the slaves in that film is to do with make you feel revolted and to build up resentment against the villains. And then he uses it with the Jamie Foxx character later in the film for a catharsis, so you can leave the cinema and feel totally satisfied that at least in this story justice has been served. But in a film like Kill Bill, he's using it totally aesthetically. So, you know, the fight between Uma Thurman's character, the bride, and the crazy 88, sword-wielding Yakuza. You know, there's no sense in which real people are being killed in that sequence. It's just something beautiful to watch. It's balletic. It's choreographed like a dance number, which is, you know, again, that stuff that he's borrowed from the Shaw Brothers films and from Japanese samurai movies. So he's able to kind of tap into all these different filmic traditions of portraying violence and use it to all kind of different ends. The one thing that he is absolutely clear about in previous interviews, certainly not during the butt-shutting Christian and Guru Murphy interview, but in previous times when he's spoken about violence, he's always been very clear that there's no connection between violence in the cinema and violence in the real world.
Right.
And now he's taking it slightly further and saying that not only that, but it's disrespectful to talk about violence in the real world by linking it to violence with cinema, because in cinema, it's escapist, it's aesthetic, and it's not something that really has any real-world import.
And yet, if we can say that what happens in the cinema doesn't affect the real world, I suppose that could be argued. But what happens in the real world certainly does affect what happens in the cinema. I mean, the idea that Quentin Tarantino is not thinking about society when he makes his films is patently absurd. It's not pure escapism or pure fantasy. There is a relationship with the viewer, and there is a relationship with the rest of the culture.
Absolutely, and there is something in the style of films that Tarantino makes that can kind of preempt more serious filmmaking. Django Unchained, of course, was released a year before 12 Years a Slave. Now, those films both treat slavery very, very differently. I would say 12 Years a Slave is a real kind of an authentic film about slavery that really investigates the condition of slavery and what it does to the slave and what it does to the master as well. Now, Django Unchained doesn't do that. Django Unchained is a revenge story but set in slave times. But it's almost made the subject more approachable, and by treating it with that kind of heightened, very genre-aware way that Tarantino treats subjects, he's possibly helped bring it onto the agenda for more serious filmmakers like Steve McQueen to then investigate.
if we can finish by talking about my favourite film of his, which is any reason, real reason why I invited you here, which is Inglourious Basterds, a movie I can watch time and time and time again. It's a movie about movies as much as it's a movie about the Second World War. I mean, there's a great deal in there about filmmaking as resistance, filmmaking as propaganda. And of course, given that part of the plot is that an actress assists assassins to kill Hitler in a way which, of course, never really happened, it's about actually this blurring the lines between art and reality. But in that, the reason why I sort of raised the violence point, he seems to be saying to me that people become trapped in a cycle of violence which ends up blotting out the morality of whatever cause there may have once been. So you have the Nazis. Obviously, the audience knows they're wrong and they're violent. But then the focus of the action is upon the American-backed Jewish resistance, who are, we actually see the violence of, and it's stomach-turning. It's revolting. It's appalling. And there's a sense that all morality, all plot, all dialogue, by the end, when you end up in a cinema which is both burning down and they're firing machine guns at the Führer, et cetera, everything ultimately becomes either ruined or almost purified by violence.
Well, I think in Inglourious Basterds, that's a very peculiar example because, like you said, it's a film that's about about cinema's ability to correct history and to make amends for history.
Right.
And we can do things in cinema. We can see reality as we wish it had been.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you can have, because the events in Inglourious Basterds didn't actually happen. But in cinema, it allows us to imagine, well, what if they did? And similarly in Django Unchained, you know, one of the most phenomenally depressing things about the whole kind of history of slavery, which is full of phenomenally depressing things, is that there was no redress. This is something that 12 Years a Slave is very, very good on, is that there's no real sense that justice has been served at the end of the film. And Django Unchained gives us that ability to say, well, at least in this situation, you know, we can come out of it and feel that cinema has played its part. So that's totally what Inglourious Basterds is doing. And Tarantino understands cinema's power to do that and to make us at least feel satisfied with what it does, even if real life can't kind of live up to that, live up to those expectations.
Finally, in Tarantino's universe, is there ever a sense of justice having been achieved?
There's a sense of revenge having been satisfied, honour having been satisfied, absolutely. And that's a theme that really he's more concerned with now than I think he
was. But even in the end of Kill Bill, which is all about getting revenge, even in the end of that, there's a feeling that it was worthless and emotionally empty and not satisfying. Because isn't she left with a daughter? I mean, doesn't she discover that the man who was chasing her all this time, you know, she did have some feelings for after all, and the final death is so kind of pointless?
Well, I think the final death in Kill Bill is more of a culmination of what she's been working towards for these two films. I mean, remember that something that Tarantino will do is that he will tell a story out of order.
Right.
In order to make the emotional journey make sense, he'll change the chronological one.
Right.
So, the famous example of that is Pulp Fiction, of course, which ends with one of one of the final scenes.
Yeah.
And so in order for us to kind of understand characters' journeys better, he will chop and change the story around. That's absolutely, again, another characteristic trait of his filmmaking. And in Kill Bill, you know, he does the same thing. He starts off mid-revenge spree. And so by the time that we reach the end, we've come to understand more about what's motivating the bride to track this guy down, her previous relationship with this man. And, I wouldn't necessarily say that the end of Kill Bill feels like, the whole mission has been a dead loss. I think it's more that the mission is burned out. And it's taken this woman from being, you know, bloodied and bruised on the floor of a wedding chapel on her wedding day, to being a fairly kind of, you know, as much contented as you can be after doing those kind of things, a contented mother.
Robbie Conin, thank you so much. I really enjoyed that. For more opinion and commentary, you can find us at telegraph.co.uk.